Our guest this morning, as I mentioned on Minnesota Reads, is Tyon Coleman. She is one of the contributors to a new anthology called A Good Time for the Truth, Race in Minnesota. And Sun Young Shin is the editor of the anthology. Tyon joins us on the phone this morning. Hey, Ty, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
It's so great to have you on the line with us this morning. I was reading through the essays in the book yesterday, and of course I grabbed yours first off. I said, oh, I'm going to be talking to her tomorrow. And I loved your voice. I loved your dry humor. I loved the things that you said and the interesting way that for me, what are European Minnesotans? Are we people of no color? I just loved, again, the way you, when you have the opportunity to read someone's words or listen to someone talk, you can see that not everybody sees the same old things that you see every day the same way. And I thought it was fascinating. Let's back up to the title, A Good Time for the Truth. What is the truth?
Well, you know, that's the complex issue, right? And I think that's why Sun Young Shin did a good job of having an anthology, because the truth is, I think, different to everyone who contributes, right? There's a way that we all have different perspectives, because there's the title of race, but as you look at each different author who contributes, like from Shannon Gibney to Vanessa Fuentes or Bao Fi, everybody has a different take on what that truth is. And, I mean, in some way, we can talk about these macro numbers around disparities and identities, but when it really comes down to it, we're all having these very unique, different human experiences of how we've encountered race. And I think maybe that's the beauty and the complexity of it, that if we can find spaces to hold everybody's truth as a way to move forward in discourse, I believe that is what happens. So, ironically, when you say truth, that's a big word, because what's true for me may not necessarily be true for you, but nonetheless, it really does affect our lives and our experiences and how we interact with each other.
I believe he's a photographer. His name was familiar to me. Wing Young Huey. He says, we're not the Vikings, Snoopy, and Mary Tyler Moore. he says, the ideas of who we are have not caught up with the realities. What does that mean to you?
You know, my interpretation is the sense that, you know, we have this ideal of who we are that it's been inherited by hundreds of years of people who have come before us. So there's this ideal, right, where we imagine ourselves, but what's the reality of who we are? And I think in some ways we're still trying to figure that out, because in many ways we keep the ideal realities help us keep us isolated from each other. And I'll give you an example. I'm a transplant. You know, I came here for graduate school in 1998. Met my husband, who's from Tanzania. We've been here married for 15-plus years, but our children are born here. And they might call themselves African-Americans or Tanzanian-Americans, but to me, they're clearly Minnesotan, you know.
When you say to them, I want you to clear the supper dishes, do they say, you betcha?
Yes, or they'll roll that L and they'll say, Mommy, I want to go to the lake. Or they're very polite and Minnesota nice and not confrontational, and so that always fascinates me, because I'm this black girl from the south side of Chicago that grew up in the inner city. I'm very direct, where my kids are not like that, and they're Minnesotan. So there's this sense that, yeah, are they black? Are they African descent? Yes, but they're also too Minnesotan. But you wouldn't look at them and think that they're European, but I would argue in some ways they have more in common with white Minnesotans than me as a black Minnesotan. So it's complex, right? So, yeah, we're these identities that were handed down to us, but we're also these identities that are intersected. And sometimes then the identities that allow us to be separated from each other, like our racial markers, then I think sometimes get in those spaces, right, and how we're treated and the result and these differences and these barriers that we work so hard to try to get through. And at least from my point of view, I think the anthology is an attempt to try to have that discourse and break through those barriers to show how we're similar and different, but we're all human beings, we're all feeling. It is interesting. I can tell you it's a work in progress. I'm still figuring it out. Even with the highs and lows, I enjoy it, right? It's a part of who we are, and at least I think in Minnesota we get to have that discourse, right? It's possible for us to hold each other in that.
Yeah. You know, I was reading along with several of the essays, and I was, you know, going along with the idea that my perception and the way that I see my everyday life as a Minnesotan, born and raised and lived here almost all of my life, and going along with that, fine. And I hit one line in an essay, and I don't even remember whose essay it was. It might even have been in the introduction, but I hit one line that stopped me right in my tracks, and I wrote it down. Children of color subject to limiting beliefs. Mm-hmm. And that handful of words seemed to be so important to pull out and to emphasize. It's like that should have been in red and like 14-point type. Somehow, when you start to say, you know, oh, it doesn't matter, or who cares, or whatever, the idea that children of color are being told they can't.
Yeah, absolutely. And Alex Pate, who writes the blurb for the book, local writer too, and founder of Innocent Technologies, he talks about this in his work and in his essays, the sense that students of color don't have innocence because they're constantly bombarded by the negative stereotypes from popular narratives and negative images, and so it impacts how they see themselves. If you allow for, like, this big fancy word, it's their epistemology. So it's sometimes not what you think about kids of color, it's what they think you think about them and what society thinks about them. And oftentimes they carry that belief, and that belief is so strong that it does limit their potential because it affects how they interact in the world. And you can imagine the very real structures around education, housing, employment, health, those things then impact that. So, yeah, that is a reality. And that's something that is discussed heavily. I mean, think about Shannon Gibney's essay when Fear of a Black Mother. Here she is, this person of mixed race. She's half white, half black. Her husband is Liberian. Her kid is black, but she thinks about the fear that she has around her black son, understanding how do you protect someone and love someone where in the dominant culture that someone or the ideal of that black someone is feared. So, yeah, that is a reality. Yeah.
Have you seen, there's a little video clip going around on social media that I saw, and again, it stopped me and it absolutely broke my heart. And when you have these aha moments where you kind of get something that you hadn't gotten before, whenever and wherever they occur, I think they're really powerful. And they had two baby dolls, a black baby doll and a white baby doll. Yeah. And they were asking the little black children, which is the good doll and which is the bad doll?
Right, right.
And then, which doll do you look like?
Right.
And they put, the good doll was the white doll, the bad doll was the black doll. And it absolutely, it would break the heart of anyone who has any feeling at all. These little children, that they had somehow internalized this as such little kids.
Yes, and that's been around for a long time, right? And it's had several different, you know, embodiments. But yeah, but that's what happens when you don't see yourself in the dominant culture. So, for example, if you're if you watch TV, you don't see someone who looks like you, or in your neighborhood, your teachers, the police officers, firemen, what have you. When the dominant culture doesn't reflect who you are, you start to think that there's something wrong with yourself. And it's so internalized at the subconscious level that you will even pick something that doesn't look like you because that's what you believe is right. And sometimes that becomes the struggle of race among many other struggles. How do you start to see yourself and love yourself for who you are? And that struggle happens, you know, early, as young as 5 or 6. But in David Mira's essay, he even writes about it as a PhD candidate at the University of Minnesota. When given a book by the poet Marilyn Nelson about Asian American poets, he puts it on the shelf, and it takes him years before he reads it because he writes that he didn't want to be associated or categorized in that way. Because sometimes there's something about the dominant culture that forces you to be white as a constructed identity, and anything that deviates from that is not seen as valued or beautiful. And that's a part of the pressure of assimilation. And again, something that has always existed since we've been constructing this whiteness European identity from the beginning, right? And that is embodied differently state by state, as you see in my essay.
Well, and as you talked about, being a creative writing candidate in a graduate program and handing in your work and having the professor critique the grammar and critique the style, And you said, no, I'm from the south side of Chicago. This is the way people talk. And there was no conversation at all. Apparently the professor couldn't see beyond the style to what it was you were trying to say.
Yeah, and I don't think that, you know, it was malicious, but it doesn't change, right, the outcome, right? And there's a way that if you can't deal with different narratives or people who are different or coming from different experiences, if that is your identity, then in some ways, then you become rendered invisible. And so I write about this notion of, we always say that we want diversity or equity, but when different bodies get into spaces, and not just bodies, I would say even different gender, sexual orientation, sometimes then those bodies aren't treated differently or they aren't allowed to voice themselves and to come into being, and then that only, like, perpetuates the oppression. And as you know, I love to use humor, so it's not offensive. I always joke that everyone says, well, we have diversity because there's the presence of all these different bodies, right, different colors, different sexual orientations, et cetera. But I would say, well, plantations were diverse, right, because there were different bodies. So it's not so much about the presence of different bodies. It's about what's the distribution of power. What power do those bodies have access to? So when I sat in those graduate seminar rooms, I had no access to power because it was made very clear early on that my aesthetic, my identities, my experiences were not correct or not part of what was considered creative writing. And in that way, I had to battle against being shut down. So not only was it a battle to be a creative writer, it was a battle to show up as a black woman who grew up poor on the south side of Chicago, right, two generations removed from the south. And sadly, you could easily replace that with someone even of a different identity or sexual orientation. So, yeah, that's silencing that happens. So you start with a very great question about what happens to our children and what they believe. I would argue if you are any human being, that's a struggle you're going to have your entire life if you're struggling in the dominant culture and you're not necessarily constructed as privileged, white and privileged and heterosexual. Yeah.
Ty, let me ask you one question. We're running out of time, but I've got to ask you. I always end up in this position when I talk with interesting people. I got to ask you one more question.
Sure, sure.
Somewhere I had written this quote from the book as I was writing. I didn't attribute any of this stuff. It was just stuff that hit me, and I wrote it down. No one should have one story of what it means and is to be indigenous, black, Vietnamese, Guatemalan, Iranian, and so on. Is there one story, though, of white people?
You know, I would say that's a really interesting question. And so you have me, and not to be nerdy, but I'm very much into deconstruction. And blackness is a constructed identity. So, too, is whiteness. So I argue that, yes, there is privilege historically and institutionally that has come with the construction of white privilege in the West. But that is an identity that is equally constructed as whiteness. So I'm always going to push against that. No, there isn't just one story. So although you have an anthology, A Good Time for Truth, Race in Minnesota, I would argue that you equally have different stories when it comes to whiteness, because in some ways the constructed white identity obscures whiteness, because everyone who's white doesn't necessarily have privilege. They aren't racist. They don't hate other people who are non-white. There are white allies. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Right.
We are all constructed identities. So it would sound nice on a postcard to say that there's one story, but I'm going to say no. Because if we perpetuate the one story, then that's how we perpetuate the silence and oppression. The part of the function of the anthology, or I would argue of art and writing of any kind of discourse, is to break down the stereotype that there's one story. In fact, the reality is that we have different stories. And Sun Yung-shun, in her introduction to the anthology, she quotes Adichie, the Nigerian writer, right, from her TED Talk, The Danger of a Single Story, and she says it's not that those single stories aren't untrue, it's just that it promotes the notion that there aren't any other stories.
Right.
And the reality is there are multiple stories. So I know that was a long-winded answer. I apologize for that, but I'm going to say no. There are multiple stories, and I think if we tell our multiple stories, that creates the ability for us to be in discourse, for us to learn from each other, and to have healing. And it's my hope that we move forward and we work to close these gaps, not just creatively and spiritually and racially, but also these other gaps institutionally, right?
Well, and it seems that the more we would communicate, the more things we would find in common, and the more things that we would find to empathize with or to regret or to make amends for, in the sense that that's awful that happened to you, and acknowledge in a genuine way instead of having a feeling that we've been pushed against the wall, whatever it might be.
That's correct.
I wish we could talk for days and days and days. But it isn't going to happen at this juncture.
Well,
anyway,
I can't thank you enough and your listeners. Thank you so much.
And Ty, thanks so much for joining us this morning. It was great to have you as a guest.
Great to be here. Peace and blessings. Thank you.
Tyon Coleman is one of the contributors to a new anthology called A Good Time for the Truth, Race in Minnesota. It's edited by Sun Young Shin. Minnesota Reads is produced at KUMD with funding provided in part by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.